Against the national politics? 5 seconds?
He's the number one donor to the GOP.
Eric LeCompte, I want to thank you very much for being with us, Executive Director of Jubilee USA Network. And that does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is hiring a seasoned Linux Systems Administrator. Visit democracynow.org/jobs for more information. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Renee Fels, Aaron Mate, Nermeen Sheikh, Steve Martinez, Sam Malkoff, Hani Masood, Rabbi Karen, Dina Gesder, Amy Littlefield. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!
This is KBOO Portland. Up next, the KBOO Evening News.
Hey everybody, elections are coming up for the KBOO Board of Directors. Right now we're looking for board candidates with skills in finance, new media, and nonprofit development. So if this sounds like you or someone you know, you can download a copy of the board candidate package at kboo.fm or pick up a copy at the station during business hours. We're at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The application deadline is midnight, June 30th, so don't delay. And thank you for supporting community radio, KBOO.
KBOO for the 27th Annual Waterfront Blues Festival. KBOO will again broadcast the entire festival from noon to 10 p.m., July 3rd through the 6th. The broadcast will also be carried by various stations of Oregon Community Media for statewide coverage of this Oregon Food Bank Benefit Festival. Again, July 3rd through the 6th, noon to 10 p.m. each day here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
This KBOO program has been made impossible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Edgefield Concerts presenting an evening with Joan Baez and Indigo Girls next Thursday. Both Indigo Girls and Joan Baez are playing full sets, also presenting Steve Winwood next Saturday. Tickets at edgefieldconcerts.com and Edgefield Box Office on the night of the show. Now, it's time for the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News,
Environment Oregon releases a new report on the toxins released into Oregon's waterways on a daily basis.
President Obama announces that 300 military advisors will be sent to Iraq.
And former Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice faces hecklers who challenge her policies on torture and war.
Ground. If we want all of Oregon's waterways to be safe for future generations, we need to restore all Clean Water Act protections, and we need to do it now. Now I would like to invite Matt Mileta, owner of Water Avenue Coffee, to speak.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Thank you, guys. As a small business owner here in Portland in the specialty coffee industry, our business and livelihood greatly depends on a clean water supply. Properly brewed coffee's 98% water, so you can imagine that it's a huge element in the quality of our product. It goes without saying that Portland's known for great coffee, and it's not a coincidence that we have excellent quality water to brew our coffee with as well. And it's not just our business, but many other coffee businesses here in Portland that are known around the world. If our water supply is polluted and undrinkable, we literally would shut our doors. I'm a native Oregonian. I grew up in Oregon, and my fondest childhood memories are those of hiking along streams and, swimming and fishing that, I'll never take for granted. And literally at risk is the literal lifeblood of what makes Oregon so special, why it's so green, why we have such a amazing environment to live in. And this affects all of us, truly, regardless of our political beliefs or our bank accounts. So absolutely, let's not let our clean waterways be disrupted or essentially ruined. So thank you guys very much.
Hi, my name is Christina, and I am manager of Pirates Cove Marina on the Multnomah Channel. We have a lot of liveaboards that depend on clean water. What a liveaboard is someone that makes their residence on their boat year-round. The water is important because we swim, play, work on the water. These waters aren't protected. I could lose my job. People could lose their homes. We need the clean water for our residents to live on. We fish, we eat out of there. I water my vegetable garden from this water. It needs to remain clean. The EPA needs to change these loopholes, close them. It's detrimental to our health, to the health of our city, the health of our state, and to the health of our future generations. From a business point of view, if they need to tax more to get clean water, I'm for it. I know people in Oregon don't like to hear the word tax, but we've got to pay for this somehow. And I'm willing to add a few cents to whatever bill I need to get it done. I want my grandchildren to swim in these waters. I swim in them now. I'm a little cautious. I shower immediately after getting out. But the laws need to be tightened up. And I don't know what more I can say other than I hope that our state system will listen to us, contact the EPA, and make this happen.
Thank you.
We've been trying to target Schrader in the Salem district, and we've been able to actually generate a lot of phone calls into his office to really put him behind on our side and the side of his constituents closing these loopholes.
And has Kurt Schrader actually responded?
We've been able to kind of push him in the right direction. Recently, the board he sits on, the Small Business Committee, wrote a letter to the EPA saying they wouldn't support closing these loopholes. But he was the only one in his committee that didn't sign it. So I like to think it's in part of because of the pressure we're putting on him.
Those were the voices of people participating in an event this morning on Portland's South Waterfront, in which a giant fish posed for pictures with pedestrians. The fish and its supporters are trying to draw attention to the number of toxins being released into Oregon's waterways.
Another police raid was carried out today in the ongoing operation targeting white supremacist gangs involved in meth production. SWAT teams from multiple jurisdictions descended on a Fairview home early this morning with flashbang grenades, detaining 6 out of 11 residents, but only arresting one. Officers said all cooperated without incident. Mark Gill, age 48, of Fairview, was arrested and charged with possession of meth, delivery of meth, and endangering the welfare of a minor. Also arrested was Kenneth Freeman, age 27, who walked up to the house's back door during the 3 a.m. bust. He was already wanted for failure to appear on a disorderly conduct charge. The Multnomah County Sheriff's Office Special Investigations Unit made the bust with help from the Multnomah County Sheriff's Office, Gresham and Vancouver Police Department SWAT teams, and the East Metro Gang Task Force. Officials said the search warrant was served as part of a continuing investigation into white supremacist gang activity, including witness tampering, drug dealing, and firearms trafficking.
An Oregon State Police captain who headed the Internal Affairs Department is heading to jail for a few days after using a state credit card to buy gas for his personal vehicle. 39-year-old Jeff Randall Lands pleaded guilty today to official misconduct, has resigned, and spent 3 days in jail plus 1 year probation. He will also pay $500 in restitution for the gas, which he bought over 6 trips to the filling station between October of last year and April 2014. Lands has been a trooper for 15 years and promoted to the head of Office of Professional Standards in 2011.
Firefighters are struggling to contain the 50-acre Owens Fire, burning about 10 miles south of Hood River. Dry logging slash on Hood River County forest land fueled the blaze, which has been whipped higher by winds, officials said. But now that it's moved into areas planted with young trees, the fire is slowing. The Hood River County forester said the slash that burned is from a timber harvest 3 weeks ago. The area that burned contained felled timber, mostly Douglas fir with some ponderosa pine. Officials said a fire line is almost complete around the blaze, and firefighters expect to have it fully lined by the end of today. It's currently 10% contained. Two contract hand crews, one hotshot crew, six fire engines, and a mix of state-owned and private equipment crews are on the scene. The incident command post for the Owens Fire is located on Pinemont Road, just past the mill. And in a related story, the conservation group Oregon Wild yesterday filed suit to challenge a national forest timber sale that they say is too close to the den where Oregon's first wolf in 70 years, OR7, and his mate are raising their young. The lawsuit was filed in U.S. District Court in Medford against the U.S. Forest Service. It demands an analysis of the harm that logging in the Bybee timber sale on the Rogue River Siskiyou National Forest could do to the fragile wolf family, as well as other endangered wildlife. Biologists monitoring the wolves don't want to reveal the den's location for fear that hunters or ranchers will kill the two adults and their pups. The last known wolf in Oregon was killed by a bounty hunter in 1946.
A bitter debate broke out today as the Eugene City Council voted to draft an ordinance requiring employees to provide paid sick leave to local workers. The policy was aimed at an estimated 25,000 workers in the city who aren't covered by similar benefits. The council also voted not to refer the measure to ballot. If passed as expected, it would be effective July 1, 2015. In Portland, city commissioners this year passed an ordinance requiring businesses with six or more employees to allow workers an hour of paid sick time for every 30 hours worked, up to 40 hours a year. In Eugene, councilors George Poling and Mike Clark voted against paid sick leave. Clark said the move would prompt a backlash. He predicted either a referendum or the ordinance or a charter amendment proposal to the head of similar policies in the future.
And a delegation of workers from Washington State are on their way to the other Washington, Washington, D.C., to participate in the first ever White House Summit on Working Families. Participants include local leaders in the fight for paid sick days, family leave, and equal pay. The delegation is being organized by the Washington Work and Family Coalition, along with 14 local partner organizations. Marilyn Watkins with the coalition spoke with KABU about the reasons for the trip.
About 40% of workers don't get any paid sick leave except for those in those cities and the one state where paid sick leave ordinances have been passed that extend sick leave to far more workers. We've been working at getting a law very similar to the Seattle law passed statewide in Washington state. Last legislative session, the House of Representatives passed it, but the Senate did not. So one of the things that we're hoping comes out of forums like the one that was held in Tacoma yesterday and one that was in Kirkland earlier, this White House Working Summit, that we have the energy and momentum really highlighting how important these issues are so that when our legislature reconvenes in January, we can get that paid sick leave passed so that everyone in Washington has access to just a few days of paid leave a year that they can use for their own health or to care for a sick family member. You know, we just know that we all do better when people aren't forced to go to work when they're sick, when kids aren't left languishing at school because no parent can come and pick them up when the child gets sick at school. You know, it's just so important for our health and our families that people have those kinds of benefits. And an issue like family and medical leave insurance, we've been working on that here in Washington State for some time. We've made a little bit of progress, but we haven't gotten a program fully funded and off the ground yet. We know there are five states in the United States that already have functioning systems in place. We can do it here in Washington State, too, and we're really looking forward to having that in place because we all know that, again, we'll all do better as a society when all parents can take a few weeks of time off to be with a newborn child, when if someone's in a serious car accident or gets cancer, when a parent is in their final illness, if people just have that time when they can heal themselves be with family members in health crises. More and more, we've heard President Obama coming out as a champion on these issues. He said in the State of the Union address back in January, I guess it was, that it's time to change when the assumption was that every household had a full-time caregiver at home. You know, that's just not the case now. It actually wasn't the case back in the 1950s and 60s either, but it's certainly not the case now, where the majority of kids, about two-thirds to three-quarters of kids, now have all of their parents in the paid workforce. And more workers also have aging parents or other older family members that they're having to take some responsibility for providing care for. But when we have, you know, everybody out there working and no one available for full-time caregiving, our workplace policies really have to change to make it possible for people to both be responsible workers and to be able to care for their family and maintain everybody's health in a way that really helps us all to prosper better. We're excited that one of the people going to the summit in D.C. is going to be a local business owner from Seattle, McKinney Howell. She was a strong supporter of the Seattle paid sick leave ordinance during the time we were working to get that passed by the Seattle City Council. She's continued to be a strong supporter of that policy and of getting a statewide bill passed. She says repeatedly that her business has grown and prospered since the Seattle paid sick leave ordinance went into effect, and that taking care of her workers is what makes her restaurant really something where people want to come back to again and again.
That was Marilyn Watkins from the Washington Work and Family Coalition speaking about the issue of paid sick leave and family leave in Washington State. A delegation of workers is on their way to the U.S. Capitol in Washington, D.C., where they will meet with other community organizers from around the country to plan a strategy to confront income inequality, wage gap issues, and to demand paid sick leave for all workers.
While we were in Bonn, you know, basically having a big party, there a lot of stuff was going on in Genoa, and part of a series, and interrupted recently by a cataclysmic event, but this is a song about shutting down the various financial institutions of the world, and it's sort of generic, vague kind of thing. You know, it can apply to whichever one you care to shut down. And it has a four-word chorus, and I hope you'll all join me with it. We shall fight them on the beaches. We shall fight them on the shore. They will bring us exploitation. We'll bring them their class war. And we'll lock down to the gates as they're spreading vicious lies. They want to dominate the world, and we see through their disguise. If they'd have one big multinational with their corporate flag.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Behind the News with Doug Henwood, about the roots of the 2008 financial crisis in the SNL drama of the 1980s. This will be followed by Rose City Native Radio at 6. At 7, it's Ear to the Streets of Portland, produced by On the Ground Collective and hosted by KBOO's Sequoyna Wright. The show focuses on issues impacting Portland's African-American community. Tomorrow's weather continues today's trend of a return of summer weather. It will be a little cooler than today, with a high of 70 as opposed to today's high of 78. There will also be a 20% chance of rain. This weekend should continue to be warm and sunny, with a very slight chance of rain. Today in history, on June 19, 1953, Julius and Ethel Rosenberg were executed for passing the U.S. atomic secrets to the Soviet Union. The couple was expected to at Sing Sing prison for charges of treason. The quote of the day is from Marion Wright Eldman, who said, "We must not, in trying to think about how we can make a big difference, ignore the small daily differences that we can make, which, over time, add up to big differences that we often cannot foresee."
We'll shut them down. We'll shut them down. We will shut them down. Sounding good. And they will infiltrate.
It's 5:18. Time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Have you noticed that the powers that be employ an entirely different standard for measuring the health of America's job market than they use for the stock market? They're currently telling us that the job market is improving. What do they mean? simply that the economy is generating an increase in the number of jobs available for workers. But when they say the stock market is improving, they don't mean that the number of stocks available to investors is on the rise. Instead, they're measuring the price, the value of the stocks. And isn't value what really counts in both cases? As a worker, you don't merely want to know that 200,000 new jobs are on the market, but what they're worth. Do they pay living wages? Do they come with benefits? Are they just part-time and temporary? Do they include union rights? What are the working conditions, etc.? In other words, are these jobs or scams? So it's interesting that the recent news of job market improvement doesn't mention that of the 10 occupation categories projecting the greatest growth in the next 8 years, only one pays a middle-class wage. Four pay barely above the poverty level, and five pay beneath it, including fast food workers, retail sales staff, health aides, and janitors. The job expected to have the highest number of openings is personal care aide, taking care of aging baby boomers in their houses or in nursing homes. The median salary of an aide is under $20,000. They enjoy no benefits, and about 40% of them must rely on food stamps and Medicaid to make ends meet. Plus, many are in the, quote, shadow economy, vulnerable to being cheated on their already miserly wages. This is Jim Hightower saying, to measure the job market by quantity with no regard for quality is to devalue workers themselves. Creating 200,000 new jobs is not a sign of economic health if each worker needs two or three of those jobs to patch together a bare-bones living.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, hightowerlowdown.org.
A former Iowa State University scientist who admitted to faking lab results to attain millions in grant money for AIDS research has been charged with four felony counts of making false statements. Dr. Don Hahn left his job as an assistant professor and a laboratory manager at the university last year after admitting that he spiked rabbit food with human antibodies. The antibodies made it appear that the animals' immune systems were reacting to an AIDS vaccine being tested. But in reality, the vaccine was having little effect. Before the fraud was detected, the research was hailed as groundbreaking. Hans said he faked the results to try and get more grant funding for the research. A truly effective vaccine that can prevent HIV has not yet been developed.
A ruling by the U.S. Supreme Court today protects whistleblowers from retaliation when they're called to testify in court about official corruption. The unanimous decision was celebrated by advocates who say this ruling could encourage more government employees to report on corrupt practices. In the past, government workers have been hesitant to cooperate with prosecutors in public fraud cases for fear of losing their livelihoods. The case was brought by Edward Lane, a former Alabama community college official who says he was fired after testifying at the criminal fraud trial of a state lawmaker. Lower courts had ruled against Lane, finding that he was testifying as a college employee, not as a citizen. Writing for the court, Justice Sonia Sotomayor said Lane's testimony was constitutionally protected because he was speaking as a citizen on a matter of public concern, even if it covered facts he learned at work. In past cases, the court has said public employees generally do not have free speech rights when they discuss matters learned at their jobs. But Sotomayor said sworn testimony in judicial proceedings, quote, is a quintessential example of speech as a citizen, unquote. The court did not address whether the ruling would apply to other public workers, such as police officers or crime investigators who routinely testify in court.
The truth about Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker alleged cheating in campaign fundraising is coming out. A federal appeals court has unsealed documents relating to a criminal probe into Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker. Allegations of improper coordination of fundraising activities were raised by prosecutors within five Wisconsin counties. The investigations into Walker's fundraising activities have been stopped previously by a federal judge. Allegations against Walker are related to the recall campaign that was raged against him, following state employee contract negotiations in 2011. While no charges have been filed against Walker, the current appeal seeks to reopen the investigation and could pose political problems for him in his upcoming election to seek another term as Wisconsin governor this fall.
Today, WikiLeaks released the secret draft text for the Trade in Services Agreement Financial Services Annex. The agreement potentially covers 50 countries and nearly 70% of world trade in services. The U.S. and the European Union are the main proponents of the agreement, which also covers cross-border data flow. The draft has been classified to keep it secret, not just during the negotiations, but for 5 years after the TISA enters into force. Despite the failures in financial regulation evident during the global financial crisis, proponents of TISA aim to further deregulate global financial markets. The draft Financial Services Annex sets rules which would assist the expansion of financial multinationals into other nations by preventing regulatory barriers. The leaked draft also shows that the U.S. is particularly keen on boosting cross-border data flow, which could allow uninhibited exchange of personal and financial data. Conspicuously absent from the 50 countries covered by the negotiations are the countries of Brazil, Russia, India, and China. The exclusive nature of TISA will weaken their position in further services negotiations. The next round of negotiations will take place in 23rd and 27th of June in Geneva, Switzerland.
President Obama announced today that he plans to set up 300 military advisors to Iraq. In today's addresses, the president tried to assure the audience that U.S. involvement would be limited.
We have had advisors in Iraq through our embassy, and we're prepared to send a small number of additional American military advisors, up to 300, to assess how we can best train, advise, and support Iraqi security forces going forward. American forces will not be returning to combat in Iraq, but we will help Iraqis as they take the fight to terrorists who threaten the Iraqi people, the region, and American interests as well.
Despite President Obama's assurances, military analysts are skeptical of the return of U.S. forces in Iraq. After 11 years of war, U.S. troops largely withdrew from Iraq last year, although without admitting defeat. Phyllis Bennis of the Institute for Policy Studies spoke this morning with Dennis Bernstein of Flashpoints about the ISIS militia group that has taken over one-third of Iraq at this point.
What do you think is driving this rage that's a part of the fighting?
Well, I think what we're seeing in Iraq is not simply a week-long offensive of the ISIS and their allies against a passive population. We're seeing the culmination of what has been several years of anger and some mobilization by a number of forces in Iraq, outraged at the level of sectarian discrimination, violence in many cases, committed by the Maliki government. This is not, as I said earlier, this is not a government that represents Iraq as a nation state, Iraq as a unified people. This is very much a sectarian government, has been since Maliki took office. And the U.S. has known that and was prepared to accept it and support him, pay his bills, build his army, knowing that it was functioning very much as a Shia militia, as a very sectarian force. The Sunni population in Iraq has been marginalized in terms of government, attacked often violently by police and military forces that are Shia in their orientation in terms of how they see themselves. There have been, for example, over the last year, a number of sit-ins, nonviolent sit-ins in largely Sunni towns protesting the government's discriminatory policies. There's been very little attention paid, and they did not accomplish their goal in terms of pressuring the government in Baghdad. But it has led to a simmering level of rage. You also have other forces. You have some leftover forces that were part of the old regime of Saddam Hussein that are still living in some of these towns. You have some former military people. Because remember, Dennis, what we're looking at here is a situation in which when the U.S. invaded in 2003, the first thing they did after overthrowing the leadership of the regime was to dismantle the entire military, sending hundreds of thousands of Iraqi soldiers home with their weapons, and to dismantle the entire government, the civil service, in what was known as the de-bathification process. What that did was to eliminate the centers of what had been largely secular nationalist views in Iraq and replaced it with sectarian-based political parties, which, of course, began to take root, began to get support from their sectarian allies in the region. Iran, of course, immediately began to support the Maliki government. Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and others have supported Sunni forces in Iraq. So this has joined the situation in Syria, where you have outside regional forces supporting with money, with arms, with training, with all kinds of things, their religious compatriots, if you will, inside Iraq.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're speaking with Phyllis Bennis of the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C., an expert on this region for many, many years. And let me ask you now to sort of expand the lens. I think it is important to talk about this in the context of the war raging in Syria, that going over the border in one way to Turkey, the other side of the border to Lebanon. This is a huge and troubling situation. What are the dangers now, given what's going on in the region?
The biggest danger is the humanitarian danger. What's happening now in Iraq is mirroring the humanitarian crisis that began in Syria over the last 3 years and has spread throughout the region. You have refugees that are being created by the rising violence across Iraq, and they're desperate to seek refuge somewhere, many of them in the same countries that Syrian refugees are finding or trying to find refuge. And that means a huge crisis for the UN's refugee agencies to find money to pay for tents, water. This is in the middle of the desert summer, the worst possible time for people to be on the road with nothing but the clothes on their back, without water, without food, without medical care. So we're seeing large numbers of refugees being created, large numbers of internally displaced people within Iraq. So the humanitarian crisis is a very, very severe one. At the political level, we're seeing this divide that's emerging where the border between Iraq and Syria is largely becoming irrelevant. It's about a 300-mile-long border that was always fairly porous. It was never a very tight border, but now it might as well not even be there, in a sense. What we're hearing is that the numbers of fighters who moved from gaining lots of experience fighting against the U.S. occupation in Iraq, and who had moved to Syria in the last several years to join the fight against the Syrian regime, are now heading back into Iraq from Syria. So you have weapons and fighters as well as refugees in both directions. So it's the makings of a humanitarian crisis on an absolutely unprecedented scale in the modern times.
Does what's going on in Iraq now have a direct impact on what's going on in Syria?
Absolutely. We're looking at very much the same forces. The ISIS itself began in Iraq in the context of fighting against the U.S. occupation, linked up with al-Qaeda, broke with al-Qaeda, joined up with other extremist Islamist forces, moved into Syria when the challenge to the Syrian regime began to take shape, gained strength there, brought in more fighters who had gained experience and know-how and weapons with many of the other anti-Assad rebel forces in Syria challenging the ISIS because of their extremism, but nonetheless, they're a powerful fighting force, very disciplined, very organized, and now very wealthy, not least because of both kidnappings for money and particularly in their takeover of Mosul. They occupied and stripped the Mosul National Bank, gaining somewhere in the area of $400 million. So they are now an incredibly wealthy agency, if you will, in that region. So the political realities that we're looking at now are very much cross-border between Iraq and Syria, and it makes the solution all the more difficult. That's why some kind of new diplomatic initiative, I think, is the only possibility for ending the slaughter that is underway.
That was Phyllis Bennis of the Institute for Policy Studies speaking about the current situation in Iraq.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.imemc.org for Thursday, June 19th, 2014. Civilians injured as the army bombards Gaza. Meanwhile, in the West Bank, the army's kidnapping campaign continues. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. A number of civilians were injured and excessive property damage was reported as the Israeli Air Force fired missiles into several areas in different parts of the Gaza Strip on Thursday at dawn. The first Israeli strike targeted Tunis School in a Zaytun neighborhood southwest of Gaza City, causing excessive property damage to buildings, nearby homes and vehicles. The soldiers also fired missiles into Abu Jarad security site near the former Netzarim settlement, causing excessive damage to the site and a number of nearby homes. The Israeli Air Force also fired at least two missiles at Al-Mukasi residential towers, causing damage to a number of homes and several injuries. Moreover, F-16 Israeli fighter jets fired missiles into the Nusayrat refugee camp in central Gaza, especially near the power plant, destroying the plant and causing damage to several nearby homes. In addition, missiles were fired into an area close to Sheikh Zayed Towers in Beit Lahia in the northern part of the Gaza Strip. One Palestinian suffered moderate injuries and was moved to Kamal Adwan Hospital. The Al-Qassam Brigades, the army of Hamas, stated that the army bombarded a number of its sites in different parts of the Gaza Strip. It added that the Israeli Air Force also fired a missile at one of its sites east of Gaza City, but the missile did not explode. Also on Thursday in Gaza, Israeli soldiers kidnapped two Palestinian fishermen in Gaza waters in northern Gaza and a Palestinian patient at the Erez terminal as he was heading to an Israeli hospital for treatment. Elsewhere, Israeli soldiers continued their extensive invasions and assaults in Hebron district in the southern part of the occupied West Bank and kidnapped 15 Palestinians, invaded and ransacked several homes and charities. The Palestinian TV has reported that the soldiers invaded the Hebron city and several nearby towns and refugee camps, kidnapping 15 Palestinians after violently ransacking and searching their homes. Moreover, Israeli soldiers kidnapped 4 Palestinians in the northern West Bank district of Nablus and 3 Palestinians, including a paralyzed man, in the West Bank district of Bethlehem. Also, dozens of soldiers invaded the central West Bank city of Ramallah and nearby villages and towns of Abud, Nabi Saleh, Kubar, Bir Zeit, Betunia, and Silwan, and violently searched dozens of homes before kidnapping 11 Palestinians. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Thursday, June 19th, 2014 news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Shmawi and me, Ghassan Bannoura.
In the latest news from U.S.-occupied Afghanistan, three separate units of Oregon National Guard soldiers have deployed to Afghanistan over the last 2 weeks. Together, they comprise over 600 local men and women who will be deployed to Afghanistan until at least the end of 2014. 4 Taliban fighters attacked a NATO post in the eastern Afghan province of Nangarhar on Thursday. The attack destroyed dozens of trucks and sparked a gun battle with police, Afghan officials said. The attack took place in the parking compound of a NATO base near Pakistani border. This is the main supply for NATO-led forces in landlocked Afghanistan. Government officials report that 18 Taliban fighters were killed last night, 12 in northern Afghanistan and 6 in Pakistan, along the border with Afghanistan. The government reported that 12 Taliban, including 4 commanders, were killed in an airstrike carried out by Afghan and coalition forces in Ghazni province last night. And at least six suspected militants were killed in a U.S. drone strike in Pakistan's tribal region.
Former Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice was heckled by protesters as she began remarks at Vermont's Norwich University in Northfield today.
Well,
As the protesters continued to shout at the former Secretary of State, the crowd began to applaud and gave Rice a standing ovation, apparently to drown out the dissenting voices. The protesters were then escorted out of the venue by various security personnel, at which point Rice claimed,
"You know, in most of the world, in a lot of places in the world, some of which the United States of America has helped and defended, people would love to be able to do just that without the secret police taking them off to jail."
In the face of a large, hostile crowd, the protesters continued to voice their displeasure with Rice and the policies she has championed. That was former Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice facing hecklers today at Vermont's Norwich University. And you're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Jimmy Tardy and myself, Lisa Loving. Our engineer is Jimmy Tardy. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews, or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. If you'd like to call your elected representative about any issue you've heard on the news tonight, here are the phone numbers, so get a pen or something to write with. The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. Oregon Governor Kitzhaber's number is 503-378-3111. Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120. You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath, 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River, 91.9 FM. I'm Lisa Loving.
And I'm Jackie Malmstrom. Coming up tomorrow on KBOO, at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, Eurus guest hosts Positively Revolting Talk Radio. At 9, Veterans Voice join Bill, Angie, and Marvin as they interview Lisa Letts, the author of Fighting for Peace, Veterans and Military Families in the Anti-Iraq War Movement. She talks about the rift the war caused in families and inside the movement. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, hear Flashpoints, Investigate, News Radio host Dennis Bernstein. At 11, it's Radio Zine host Kathleen Stevenson speaks with artist blogger Danielle Crissa about her new creative book, Creative Block. Get unstuck, discover new ideas, advice, and projects from 50 successful artists. And at 11:30, hear an interview with Beehive Design Collective about their final image in their trilogy about globalization in the Americas, and focusing on the resistance to mega infrastructure projects that are literally paving the way for free trade agreements that devastate local communities and economies. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. And if you're not currently a member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking donate today. Stay tuned now for Behind the News with Doug Henwood about the roots of the 2008 financial crisis in the SNL drama of the 1980s.
Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. Today's topics, fraud and food. In a minute or two, we'll hear from Jennifer Taub, who will trace the roots of the 2008 financial crisis to the savings and loan mania of the 1980s. Before we begin, a hybrid apology complaint. People are cutting their landlines like crazy. This is hard on a radio producer who does a lot of phone interviews. Skype can be good, but it isn't always, and cell phone signals are almost always worse than landlines. I do the best I can, but sometimes the reality falls short of my aspirations. I'm very aware of this and wish the audio were as clear as Waterford. It's not always. Sorry. My first guest is Jennifer Taub. Taub, a professor of law at the University of Vermont, is author of Other People's Houses, How Decades of Bailouts, Captive Regulators, and Toxic Bankers Made Home Mortgages a Thrilling Business, just out from Yale University Press. The use of thrilling in the subtitle is a nice touch. Back in the old days, mortgage banking was a dull affair, dominated by savings and loans. They'd take deposits from regular people and use the money to fund 30-year mortgages, which they'd keep on their books for all three decades. Some people got rich, but for most participants, it was a sleepy business. Starting in the 1970s and accelerating majorly in the 1980s, however, it turned into a hot business. No longer did SNLs keep loans in their books. The model became one of loan production. Make the loans, few questions asked, package bunches of them into bonds, and then sell them via Wall Street banks to institutional investors. It got truly insanely reckless, culminating in the 2008 financial crisis. But the roots of the story in the 1980s is often forgotten. Jennifer Taub does a nice job remedying that oversight. One of the things I really liked about your book is that you start back in the, well, actually with the deregulation of the late 70s, but things really got going with the savings and loan crisis of the early 80s. That's largely forgotten now, it seems. But start the story for us there. I mean, what are the roots of the recent debacle in the experiences of the late 70s, early 80s?
Well, I see that the entire toxic mortgage-backed chain was enabled by incremental acts of deregulation and de-supervision. So there, when most folks look at the financial crisis, they begin the story with either the run on Bear Stearns in March of 2008 or the collapse of Lehman Brothers in September of 2008. And by doing so, they're ignoring the key point that this most recent financial crisis began as a mortgage crisis. And so in looking at the mortgage crisis then, for those who look at that, there is also an unfortunate tendency to point to so-called subprime borrowers as being the folks who got us into a mortgage crisis. So the story that gets repeated over and over again says that there were people who couldn't afford to buy homes and had no intention of paying back their mortgages, duped sophisticated bankers into giving them loans, and then defaulted. And with this story, somehow, we then get to a banking collapse brought on, again, by these subprime borrowers who fooled these sophisticated bankers, and then we needed a multi-trillion dollar bank bailout. And that story is obviously something I'm trying to debunk in my book, but in order to actually look at the root causes, you have to go back and ask, well, why was it that, number one, folks were given mortgages that they couldn't afford? They, of course, didn't trick bankers into it. These mortgage loans were pushed on people at higher rates and on terms that they eventually could not afford. And in some cases, people who already owned their homes but were pushed into loans that stripped their equity and their savings from them and left them homeless. So that's one part. You have to say, well, how did that happen? And then the second part is, how is it that the default on home mortgages led to a massive banking crisis? It wasn't just the failure of these mortgages. It was the way that banks were highly leveraged themselves and had loaded up on mortgage-linked securities and placed a whole bunch of side bets on these. So those two pieces of the elements of the recent crisis were enabled by decades of deregulation that began back in the 1970s.
Yeah, I recall a Wall Street Journal sort of look back, roundup, thumb-sucking piece after the savings and loan disaster probably late 80s, early 90s. And the phrase that I remember is that it represented the criminalization of the nearly the entire professional class of the United States. Now, well, I'm not quite sure I would use the word criminalization, but there were just so many people involved in private and public life in producing a disaster of this magnitude that it's hard to, you have to have a lot of fingers to point.
That's true. So just kind of going back to the savings and loan crisis, and just to make this point, what I argue in Other People's Houses is that the 2008 crisis was really just a repeat of the same disease that caused the savings and loan debacle. And you mentioned the criminalization of an entire industry. What happened in the late 1970s, early 80s, is that the savings and loans were failing, not at first due to anything that the owners or operators of these savings institutions were doing, but because of these exogenous shocks. So in particular, we were undergoing massive inflation, and to tame inflation in October of 1979, Paul Volcker, who was then chairman of the Fed, decided to essentially let interest rates flow as high as they might. And as a result, when interest rates shot up, what happened to the savings and loans is that they faced imminent collapse. And this is because they were carrying, you know, the savings and loans were set up just like George Bailey's Building and Loan in It's a Wonderful Life. Their whole purpose was to take in savings and channel those in mostly into mortgage loans. And it was a pretty simple business. They made money on the spread. So you have mortgages that pay you more than the interest you have to pay out to savers. You keep your overhead low, and it works.
Yeah, there was the old 3-6-3 rule, right? You take deposits at 3%, lend them out in mortgages at 6%, and you're on the golf course by 3. That was the old S&L industry.
Exactly. It was kind of a no-brainer business, and it served communities, and it helped get people into homes and the like. But what happened when interest rates spiked is that the S&Ls had to pay their savers much higher rates than they were bringing in on those mortgages. They were on a market value basis hugely insolvent. And so there was this moment we're now at the end of the Carter, we get into the Reagan administration. So there's this moment at this transition between these administrations, sort of late 1980 and then later in 1982 under Reagan, when the industry, clamoring for help from their regulator, their federal regulator, and from Congress, says we need help and gets this huge deregulation program through. The theory was, let's let them grow out of their problems. Let's let these savings and loans get into all manner of asset classes, not just making mortgage loans, but building loans and even junk bonds. So let's loosen them up on what they can do with the money that they bring in. So that's sort of the asset side of the balance sheet. But also, there was allowing them to bring in big quantities of money through what was known as brokered deposits. So instead of just you and me and, you know, moms and pops taking our savings and putting it in the local savings and loan, channeling money in huge chunks and huge sums into these savings and loans, and then, you know, again, taking that money, not loaning it for mortgage loans, but into supposedly higher yielding investments to make up for the fact that they were losing money due to the interest rate environment. And this is where the criminal element came in. Because the model for the federal deregulation of savings and loans came from some of the states, including Texas, which had deregulated its savings and loans in the 1970s, and they had been showing huge profits at first, but a lot of that was built on a kind of Ponzi scheme type financing project, which began to collapse in the mid-1980s, shortly after the federal deregulation.
One of the things that was so impressive about reading your book is there are 30 years of unlearned lessons. You keep saying the same things. You know, it seems, you know, reckless on the face of it to allow a real estate developer to own a bank and lend himself money for development. Yet we did that hundreds and hundreds of times during the savings and loan mania.
Yeah, it does. And yet It's one of these things, and you see it again and again with banking regulators, that they are pressured or believe that when you see an institution thriving, that you really can't look any further, because if they, you know, they would be job killers or hurting success. Because, of course, in the way these schemes work is that everything, when loans are made to a developer for, let's say, a piece of land well above the land's value, as long as a loan is big enough to make to leave some money in the, you know, money in there to make the initial payment, it doesn't all fall apart until the very end. And so there can be a period of months or years when the bank looks like it's doing very well. They also engaged in this these kinds of, there were these schemes called cash for trash. So if you had a bad loan on your books, let's say you were a savings and loan, and you loaned to someone for a parcel or for an office building, and the office building was sitting empty and the loan wasn't performing, you would sell that loan to somebody else. Let's say a borrower who came in who just wanted to borrow, you know, $1 million, you might, if you're a corrupt savings and loan, say, okay, you know, I'm not going to loan you the $1 million to do that addition to this building, but I, or to help start up a restaurant, I'm going to loan you $20 million, dollars, and you're going to use some of the proceeds of that loan to buy my bad loan from me. And so everything, you know, was a form of cooking the books and accounting fraud. But what I'd like to also say with the savings and loans, you know, there were a lot of corrupt folks at some of them, but in some cases, the corruption came from above, in that part of helping the savings and loans look better was a whole new accounting scheme called regulatory accounting principles, which I don't want to get too much into the weeds, but it was a way to try to make the balance sheets of these savings institutions look stronger than they actually were.
I'm speaking with Jennifer Taub, author of Other People's Houses, How Decades of Bailouts, Captive Regulators, and Toxic Bankers Made Home Mortgages a Thrilling Business, just out from Yale University Press. You talk about when Obama was taking office, the issue of mortgage relief, principal write-downs came up, and you quote Barney Frank saying that Obama gave that away on the way to the Oval Office. How did he give that away?
Well, when he was a senator and he was a candidate campaigning for the presidency, as recently as the day after Lehman Brothers failed, Barack Obama was calling this treatment of homeowners in bankruptcy a Washington loophole, and that he was going to close. He thought it was unfair that a family that owns one home couldn't go into bankruptcy court to help write down their mortgage. And let's just be clear, no one expects every family to go into bankruptcy court when the housing price drops a little. We're talking about, you know, a massive collapse in home prices. And even with that, not everybody would file for bankruptcy. The idea is that if you were in distress and you were trying to restructure your loan, you would have more bargaining power with the servicer, because we know what happened with the servicers dual tracking people, saying we're working on a restructuring, but then at the same time proceeding with a foreclosure. If a homeowner had the ability to file for bankruptcy, that wouldn't happen. So going back to the candidate Obama, you know, he at big rallies, he said this was something he was going to fix. But then you might recall that right around after Lehman failed, was when Treasury Secretary Paulson and others were asking the Congress to authorize the $700 billion blank check at the time for the Troubled Asset Relief Program, and it didn't get through Congress. And there is a bit of a crisis at the moment, and around that time, John McCain announced he was suspending his campaign and he was going to rush down to Washington to try to help. And right around that same moment, candidate Obama spoke with Harry Reid and others, and with Nancy Pelosi, and told them privately that they should drop bankruptcy reform. And it was dropped. And the sense that housing advocates got was that there was either an explicit or an implicit promise that that if he were elected, he would take care of this when he got into office.
But he didn't.
But he didn't.
Okay, and finally, have we learned anything? Has this gigantic crisis finally changed the way we think and act, or are we poised to repeat the same mistakes in the coming years?
Let me start with the good news. The good news is we now have a Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. And I think that's an excellent development. And it's already taken some good steps to stop the kinds of really predatory mortgage underwriting that we saw. However, in terms of a bigger picture, there were incremental improvements made to make the financial system somewhat safer through the Dodd-Frank Act and its implementation. But unfortunately, it's not safe enough, and I don't think we have fully learned our lesson, unfortunately. Leverage at the giant banks is permitted to be just as high as it was before the crisis. The large banks are still relying heavily on short-term financing. So just like the savings and loan relied on broker deposits, which were very fragile form of financing, our big banks today rely on another form of very short-term wholesale funding, the same kind of funding that brought down Bear Stearns and Lehman Brothers. So that is still continuing. So there's much more work to be done.
And we've gone from a situation in which we have banks that are too big to fail, as some people say, now they're too big to save.
Well, we shall see. I mean, the largest banks are now substantially larger than they were before the crisis, but now we're being told that that size does not matter, that they're no longer too big to fail because of this new resolution authority, is what it's called in the Dodd-Frank Act. I'm skeptical.
That was Jennifer Taub, a professor of law at the University of Vermont, and author of Other People's Houses, How Decades of Bailouts, Captive Regulators, and Toxic Bankers Made Home Mortgages a Thrilling Business, just out from Yale University Press. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 6:01. Next, coming up, is Rose City Native Radio. Stay tuned.
June 20th, 2014, Stories from the Streets is a groundbreaking celebration at Pioneer Square in Portland, Oregon, dedicated to exploring the life of hip-hop in the Pacific Northwest. Our mission is to raise awareness on the positive influences and lifelong benefits that hip-hop culture has had on our homeless youth and our community. All proceeds